You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome to the CEO Series. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University. Each week, the CEO Series takes you inside the minds and lives of some of Canada, indeed the world's top leaders, to discuss strategy, leadership, and today's pressing issues. And some of the world's top leaders have spent time with us, like Justin Trudeau, Muhammad Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize winner, and Sir Richard Branson. This show gives you a thin, well, perhaps not so thin slice, the kind of thoughtful leaders leading some of today's most successful organizations. Today, I'm delighted to be in Calgary speaking with Ed Sim, CEO of WestJet, Canada's second largest air carrier. Thank you, Ed, for joining us today.
That's a pleasure, Cal. Great to be back on the show.
So tell us about your early years. Where did you grow up and what did your family, what were they up to?
Yeah, I grew up in a medium-sized town, I guess you'd call it, called Swansea in South Wales. Quite an industrial, I'd say a working-class town. My parents were, I guess you'd define them these days as lower middle class. They were academics. My father was the head of the English faculty at Swansea University. My mother was an actress who then went on to teach herself and then ended up taking articles to be a solicitor, one of four children. So it was interesting.
So, Ed, you were saying is that you, after graduating from Oxford, you moved to London, worked in the airline industry.
Yeah, I worked at Gatwick Airport. I started working for a charter airline at the time called Air Europe, who were part of a vertically integrated tour operating and retail operation that was very fashionable at the time in the 80s. What was very helpful was to have the opportunity to work in a number of different areas. So I worked as a check-in agent at Gatwick. I worked as a vacation rep in places like Spain, Greece, in Austrian ski resorts. I worked in cruise scheduling. I worked in revenue management. So one of the huge benefits that I had from working in smaller entities was the ability to develop breadth as well as technical depth. And I often think now, when I look back, you know, there are very, very few jobs that I haven't actually done across the spectrum of aviation.
No, it's interesting because most Oxford grads, it'd be beneath them to serve on the counter. So how did you have the good sense and humility to do that? But on the other hand, it prepared you enormously well for running an airline, much better than the average person.
Oh, absolutely. And I couldn't wait to get out of the cloistered environment of academia. It wasn't me. I knew it wasn't me. I didn't think I was smart enough for a start. But what I really wanted to do was get operational experience and actually get out and meet people. Maybe unusually for an English grad, I found that I could just talk to anybody, you know, in a market, in a pub, it doesn't matter where it was. And of course, working at an airport was a great opportunity to talk to people. So I found that those sorts of roles, and particularly when I came to be vacation rep in places like, you know, Ibiza or Greece, you lived off the commission on the excursions that you sold that day. And if you didn't sell any, you didn't have anything to eat. And I found that wonderful training for the whole power of selling and persuasion. But you're living on your wits and you're living on your ability to articulate and you're living on the ability to manage relationships. And what the heck is running an airline if it isn't those three?
So what left you to leave the UK and move down to the south?
A woman.
Okay.
So I met my wife at a trade convention in Jerusalem in the late 80s. She was a Kiwi. I didn't know a huge amount about New Zealand at the time. And we were perfectly happy living in London for several years after that. But I always knew that Claire had a hankering to move back to the Southern Hemisphere. So in 2001, we moved to Melbourne. And, you know, that proved to be a wonderful series of moves living between Melbourne, Auckland, Wellington. And it just enabled, it opened that part of the world up to me in a way that I hadn't expected. And it now feels like home, even if it wasn't where I was born.
So it's interesting. In some ways, Australia and New Zealand have led the world of aviation at times, but so did the UK. Working with Sir Richard Branson, you know, there was kind of the virgin experience. Were both ones that you could learn from, for sure?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Australia and New Zealand are so far from anywhere in real terms that they are nations of inveterate travelers. You know, New Zealand has the highest per capita passport ownership of any country in the world because nowhere is short haul. Everywhere is a long trip. I also think in the UK, and this is, again, useful experience when it came to Canada, the weather's not great, and everybody has to head south during 5 or 6 months of the year. So I think, in a funny way, that was a good preparation, living in an overcrowded small island where most people felt the desire, if they had the ability, to escape and get out and travel abroad. So these things move very quickly from being luxury or elitist purchases to becoming a fact of life and becoming commoditized. So I think that was, very good preparation in both parts of the world for the job that I came to do here in Canada.
We're speaking with Ed Simpson of WestJet, one of Canada's top airlines. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. So you moved from New Zealand directly to Calgary then?
Yeah, I did a foolish thing. I was running air traffic control for 6 years as CEO of Airways New Zealand. And I finished that job on a Friday night, and I started this job on a Monday morning. I probably wouldn't do that again because I had to pick up a hire car and then remember that I actually had to drive on the correct side of the road. So that acclimatization was a bit of a shock when I moved. That said, it made for an absolutely seamless transition to move from one part of the aviation industry into this part, which is where my love always sat. I love being a poacher turned gamekeeper. I ran air traffic control and then came into airlines and have done nothing but moan about air traffic control prices ever since.
In Canada very high.
Which are extremely high, and higher in Canada than almost any other part of the world. But it does mean you understand negotiations and you understand those commercial relationships from both sides of the fence. And I think that's invaluable.
So WestJet in Calgary, how did they find you in New Zealand?
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. Towards the end of the first decade of this millennium, was doing quite a lot of groundbreaking interior product work on aircraft. Air New Zealand were the world's second customer of the Dreamliner behind ANA. And we'd planned a lot of bespoke product that took 2 to 3 years of genesis, of not going anywhere near an aircraft, of building seats, of building designs with orange boxes or whatever else came to hand. And we tested these concepts. I developed a product that was called the Sky Couch that was effectively the world's first and is still the world's first lie-flat economy class seat, which was really designed for an adult and a couple of kids. Wow. Largely because at the time I had two young kids who were, quite challenging to travel over large sectors. We developed a wonderful concept called the Space Seat, which was a premium economy seat where the eye line was 180 degrees away from the eye line of the guest sitting next to you. So we planned these concepts. I was working with a Palo Alto design organization called IDEO, who were just phenomenal in dealing with customer pain points. And we launched a lot of that product around 2009. And the then chief executive of WestJet, Greg Saretsky, rang me in 2010 and said, "I love what you're doing. If you ever come through Calgary, let me know." And at the time I was living in Auckland, I didn't have much call really to travel through Calgary, but I was in Seattle taking delivery of a 777-300 with our new product on, and Greg asked me to come over, and I did, and the rest is genuinely history. I didn't join there and then. He rang me. I came to Calgary first in a suit jacket and a shirt when it was minus 25 in Calgary. Went back to New Zealand, was sitting at my home in Boxing Day when it was plus 25, and Greg said, "So are you coming?" And I said, "Are you kidding?" But over the course of a number of years, I began to realize what an extraordinary opportunity there was in Canadian aviation, and very specifically with WestJet, to help the next stage of the journey.
You're listening to the CEO Series, and today we're speaking with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. Do you manage differently in New Zealand and Australia than you do in Canada and the UK? Like, do you have to adjust your style, or is it pretty much you're you?
I like to think I'm still me. Okay. I like to think my personal values are my personal values, and those don't change. And, particularly in areas like authenticity, where I like my spoken voice to align with the written voice. But there are significant changes in the corporate environment, and I think it would be naive and arrogant not to spend the first 3 to 6 months sitting and listening. And one of the bigger contrasts, I think, particularly between the Southern Hemisphere and Canada, has been that the Southern Hemisphere really does focus on more generalism in leadership. They really do focus on breadth rather than technical depth. And the ultimate compliment you can pay in terms of a job title in Australia and New Zealand is general manager. Here, general manager is kind of almost deemed to be a kind of dog's body, as opposed to being someone who has the ability to move seamlessly from finance to operations to HR to the commercial world. And I think I can see the benefits and assets of both, but I am someone who has been extremely fortunate through my career to have exposure to all of those different disciplines. And that's what helps you become a chief executive.
So what is leadership today for you, Ed? And it's an exam question from Oxford. Compare and contrast to 20 years ago. Is it different now than 20 years ago, or is it still the same thing?
No, I think there's a far greater expectation and requirement of the role. You know, I can honestly say, even if the organizations were not as progressive as I'd like to think they were 20 years ago, there was very little expectation for a leader to talk about diversity and inclusion. There was very little expectation to talk about ESG matters. They were considered political as opposed to the commercial or technical world of aviation management. Now, my WestJetters, the people in this organization, have an expectation, and I think rightly so, that I will take a position on Black Lives Matter, that I will take a position on our LGBTQ population, that I will take a position on our Indigenous representation. I think that's positive, but I think some of it has stemmed from an absence of declarative leadership at a political level. And I do think it's fascinating to think of the extent to which now business leaders are being asked to step into a vacuum.
Today I'm delighted to be speaking with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet, one of Canada's top airlines. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll talk about Ed's experience in the airline industry in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the UK.
Top-notch insight from proven leaders. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today in Calgary with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. It's interesting because I'm doing a column every 2 weeks where I interview Indigenous leaders. The first one outside Canada we're going to do is in New Zealand. So New Zealand, it's been a bigger issue, I think, for many years. Give us your sense on that.
Look, these are sensitive issues, and I'm incredibly conscious of being someone who the Māori would refer to as Pakeha, or European antecedents. Okay. So I've learned, and I've probably learned as much from my mistakes or misjudgments as I have from good decisions in these areas. But, you know, one thing I've learned, Carl, is that Māori in New Zealand don't have an easy life. It's easier, and the society is more naturally integrated than might have been the case for Aboriginal people in Australia or in Canada, but it's by no means easy. And, you know, one of the things that's always pained me is Māori are 15 to 20% of the population, but grossly overrepresented, for example, in prison communities or in mental health statistics. So I wouldn't like anybody listening to this who doesn't understand the relationship between Māori and Pākehā in New Zealand to think that it's plain sailing. It's not. But there are a number of characteristics of the Māori population. They were always a settled population. They believed in building communities and would settle. They were not nomadic. They didn't wander. They have effectively, to a large extent, a single language and a single dialect, which is very unifying. And I find as a non-native New Zealander, I can use phrases, I can use Māori language without any sense of that being inappropriate or cultural appropriation. And one of the interesting aspects, having come to Canada, it had more echoes actually of Australia than it did for me than New Zealand in a number of different ways. One, that not just dialects, but languages are almost entirely distinct and different. And there's 360 tribes as opposed to one not quite homogenous. I mean, the Māori people are divided into what's called iwi, which is the word for tribes, but they probably have more in common than they have, for example, amongst the tribes between the Musqueam in the west and, you know, the Ojibwe people out east. But the language is a unifying force. It makes it easier for Europeans to understand and to engage with the language. They are, of their nature, Māori descended from Hawaii. So the nature of the people are Polynesian rather than Melanesian. And it has quite a significant effect, I think, in terms of skin color. It's much harder to distinguish, and therefore it's much harder to segregate. And I think that was probably a reason why Māori culture is much more closely integrated into general society in New Zealand than is the case necessarily in Australia, or is sadly the case here in Canada. But I do think there are strong lessons, and those are lessons that I have worked with colleagues at WestJet to try to understand how we can use those as bridges into Indigenous culture into Canada. And I feel like we've started to make progress, but there's so, so much more to be done.
We're speaking with Ed Simsiu of WestJet, one of Canada's top airlines. I'm Coral Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. So EDI is important. I mean, you look at the number of women in senior roles and things like that. Another big issue for my students is ESG, I mean, environment particularly. And I know the industry's got under fire to some degree, perhaps unfairly. But what is WestJet doing to reduce its environmental impact? My students insist I ask you that.
And rightly so. There was a time in the early 2000s when I worked for a ultra-long-haul airline like Air New Zealand, where I would start every presentation saying, my name's Ed Sims, I work for an airline, I'm a polluter. Mm. Almost like you'd start an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it starts. It starts by acknowledging that the impact of carbon dioxide in the environment, it may only be 2% of noxious emissions, but it's accentuated at 35,000 feet. So I think we start by acknowledging that there is a negative impact, and then you start with the commitment to saying, well, how are you going to tackle it? Are you going to tackle it with offsets? Are you going to tackle it with sequestration? Are you going to tackle it at a more basic level with simply improving your procedures and your processes? So here at WestJet, it starts with ensuring that we continue to have the youngest, most fuel-efficient fleet in Canada, which we do by a good couple of years. So therefore, you are obviously reducing your emissions. It starts, and this is helpful for me with my background in air traffic control, of looking at your procedures and your processes into every airport and moving away from step descents towards glide descents that can be operated perhaps on, you know, one engine and are a series of continuous movements rather than the typical holding pattern descent saves thousands of tons of fuel every single year. But it also starts by having an active interest in exploring alternatives, not necessarily the food byproducts that were examined in, you know, in the early 2000s when Virgin and others got themselves in trouble for using coconut oil or palm oil derivatives. Nor can you rely on some of the more noxious byproducts. I used to experiment on engine fuel with a nut called Jatropha. Now, there is nothing that's related to food stock about Jatropha, but the reality is that sometimes moving in those more sustainable alternatives can burn more fossil fuel than you actually save in the operation. So, you know, here at WestJet, we're more interested now in synthetics, and we're more interested in how you can build up the calorific equivalent of fossil fuels, probably as a blend. But there are all kinds of complexities. You've got to have a dedicated pipeline so that you're not contaminating your supply. Tankering can work to a limited effect, but until you can get to mass production, you're not going to be able to supplant one with the other. The important place is to acknowledge the negative impact you have and then start with a whole series of procedures. For us, fuel is 95% of our emissions, and so the major effort is not about having electronic vehicles at an airport. It's about how do you reduce the number one cause of your problem, which is burning less fossil fuel. And I'm scarred. You know, to some extent, I was interviewed in 2008 by a journalist from The Guardian called George Monbiot, And at the time, I felt we had a very strong sustainability story. And George Monbiot once said to me, surely flying to New Zealand is like driving to a Greenpeace rally in a Hummer. And I learned from that, you never, ever greenwash. You build your track record, you reduce your emissions before you get out on the front foot and tell people your good intentions.
You're listening to the CEO Series, and today we're speaking with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. But this is something where WestJetters are absolutely, almost to a person, wanting to do this.
Oh, absolutely. And it can be as simple as reducing single-use plastics. And that's something that every flight attendant, every ground staff, every pilot can get behind as well. If we lead a life that's based on recycling and reduction of damaging substances, then that leads on to the bigger picture of saying, how do you make sure that whenever you're buying new aircraft, you're buying the most fuel efficient, the most modern of its type that you can buy.
And then also, I mean, it's something where one of the joys of our lives, of our times relative to, and our kids to some degree, is just, I've been to 71 countries. I've taken students all over the world. This is one of the joys of our life. Will our kids or our grandkids be able to do that is a question. But if we have much improved technology and offsets, maybe they can.
And that's something that does trouble me. The reason I've built a career in aviation is because I have loved the privilege of being in an industry that has such a constructive purpose. Mm. It's not a habit that you believe is necessarily a negative habit, perhaps for colleagues in the liquor industry or in the gambling industry, where the more repeat purchase, the more corrosive effect you're having on society and on individuals. I think the opposite is true, because I think we are in the business of building bridges around the world, not walls. But that said, if we do not come up with effective offset methodologies, then our kids are going to look on aircraft as giant cigarettes.
Yeah.
And they're going to say it's the same effect, and it is a truly corrosive habit. And, you know, the fine line between binge flying and flying as a means of simply enabling your life becomes blurred and indistinct. And then everything becomes characterized as indulgence and binge flying, which would be hugely damaging for our industry.
Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet, one of Canada's top airlines. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll talk about Ed's thought on strategy and how WestJet fared throughout the COVID-19 pandemic.
Exclusive access to some of the most successful leaders out there. This is the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today in Calgary with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. So you're stepping away from WestJet shortly. In your years here, putting COVID-19 to the side for a minute, which is a fair bit of it, how has WestJet evolved in your time? How's it different?
I'm not an entrepreneur, and I've tended to come in to either inherit parts of a business or at least work for inveterate entrepreneurs. I was fortunate to work at Virgin under Sir Richard Branson. When I first joined here, working for the founder of WestJet, Clive Beddoe, who I'm still convinced will be Sir Clive Beddoe one day, reminded me very much of Richard, an astonishing appetite for risk, the ability to move at speed. And in Clive's case, it was always he or she with the lowest cost will always win. So I think those basic principles are ones that I understand. But I think what I've added to it is what every WestJetter will laugh when they hear me say this, because I've said it so many times, is structure, process, discipline. You know, I'm not the entrepreneur who always gets invited to cocktail parties. I'm the boring corporate guy who sits in the corner that nobody quite knows what they do. But for me, the ability to take the entrepreneurial instinct in this organization and layer on the ability to repeat key functions exceptionally well at the lowest cost for the best outcome for our guests is something that I find hugely motivating. But I come back to if you can balance those relatively gray corporate values against personal values, for me, retaining a sense of humor, retaining a sense of humility, and always retaining our humanity in the way that we build travel experiences has been a very powerful blend. And I think that's something that I feel WestJet does as well as any other airline in the world.
I'm impressed. Three H's. That you've put some thought into that, or you had a communications person with you.
But no, it's all mine.
It's all no. Sorry, Richard. But so COVID-19, was there a day when you shut it down more or less?
There were a couple of days that are more marked than others. One was February the 29th, which was a Sunday afternoon, purely coincidentally our 24th birthday, when that was the first time. I normally will look at bookings for the forward week on a Sunday afternoon. That's the kind of exciting guy Mrs. Sims married. But it was the first time I've seen a screen go completely red. And that said to me that cancellations were outstripping bookings. It's not something you ever want to see. My first thought was there must be a major system failure. And then, of course, you have the second thought that maybe this is COVID hitting. We then went on to have 72 consecutive days of cancellations outstripping new bookings. That's not something I've ever seen, and I never want to see again. So that was a very significant day. And then in the middle of March, when our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said publicly, now is the time to come home. It's not the time to travel. We're going to bring Canadians home. And we had a very short window where we were able to bring the majority of our fleet back to this country in case they got stranded. And we had a very short window where I was actually able to give WestJet as options. I had to say to everybody, we're going to have to cut an enormous amount of cost out of this business because all of the demand has just drained. But we were able to give WestJet as 5 or 6 days that instead of giving them a pink slip and saying, you're in, you're out, we were actually able to say, would you like to be working from home? Do you want to be working reduced hours? Do you want to take early retirement? Are you prepared to stand down and be furloughed for a period of time? And having been myself through two total airline collapses, one in 1991 and again one in 2001, it was my ambition and vision to at least give people a degree of control. It was a horrible situation. But if you just give people a degree of control over how they want to manage the way that they stand down to let the airline stand up, then people feel that they are playing an active part rather than being a passive victim.
You're listening to the CEO Series, and today we're speaking with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. Today, where is WestJet compared to what it was before the pandemic? Are you like 60%? What roughly where are you?
Yeah, we're somewhere between 60 to 70%, and that's a quicker return than I'd anticipated at this point. I thought, I knew, in common with most in the industry, that these disastrous 18 months have wiped about 4 years of profitability from the industry globally as a whole. I knew that we didn't have 4 years to wait to restore that profitability. But having said that, the speed of the recovery from having carried just over 100,000 guests in May to carrying 1 million in August just blew me away. And part of it was this sense of pent-up or revenge travel that people were desperate to be able to travel again. Part of it, obviously, is the greater confidence that comes from a highly vaccinated population and people feeling that strong sense of reassurance. And part of it, obviously, was stimulated by us by making sure that we continue to fly to 34 cities around Canada all the way through the pandemic. We never left. We maintained our services to almost every city that we flew. And I think people recognize that. We were shifting essential workers from Nova Scotia and from Newfoundland over to the resource areas in Alberta. We were shifting essential supplies and PPE. We were moving medical supplies in our cargo bellies. And I think that sense of commitment to this vast country, that we didn't walk away and didn't abandon our station, I think has been very, very well understood by Canadians.
So business people in the past, my time, you had to go press the flesh. You got on a plane, flew to Vancouver for an hour meeting, and I flew to Europe twice for an hour meeting, which environmentally I wouldn't do anymore. But are business travelers just saying we're going to do more Zoom? How do you see business travel evolving?
I think it'll evolve in two ways. And we find this even ironically working for an airline. I could fly to St. John's in Newfoundland and I could talk to 20 WestJetters and we could have a wonderful conversation. It would take me 2 days. I can now do a Teams, a Microsoft Teams call or a Zoom call, and I could have 5,000 WestJetters, and I have regularly on those calls, and it takes an hour of my time. So where I think business travel will evolve will be there will be a much clearer disparity between those external relationships where pressing the flesh, the personal relationship, the ability to look directly into somebody's eyes will always remain of paramount importance. But I do think the days of 2 days of flying for a one-hour meeting with 20 people are gone. And I think organizations like ourselves with remote rostered workforces will find it harder to justify being on a plane for internal communication that can now be managed with astonishing reliability through new technology.
So that's going to hurt your business over time. It's going to evolve it. Maybe some of the big players, like the Air Canadas and the Deltas of the world, where they have this, you know, live flatbeds and they charge a lot, and not entirely inappropriately, they may affect them more. But it just, so the structure of the industry is going to be a bit different in a couple of years.
I think there'll be positives and negatives. You know, one of the great advantages of working from home is people are no longer necessarily constrained by the number of vacation days they have. So provided the work is getting done and the outcome or the output is as strong as it was when they were conventionally spending 8 or 9 hours in an office like this one, then I think actually people will have more leisure time and they're more likely to take more frequent, longer weekends. So I think it's how you replace that travel. We have lie-flat beds on our 787. They're a lot cheaper than most of the competition. But what we are finding is that people will now trading up their leisure pursuits. So if they're taking fewer flights, they're pretty determined to do them at the front of the plane rather than towards the back of the plane. So we, to date, as the market has recovered, we have been really, really pleased with improved yields and with the occupancy of our forward cabins on both narrow-bodied and wide-bodied, because I think people are now saying, to heck with it, I haven't traveled in a year, I've saved all that money. So people are actually channeling, I find, a lot more of that discretionary income into air travel.
Today I'm delighted to be speaking with Ed Sim, CEO of WestJet, one of Canada's top airlines. I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. Next up, we'll talk about whether Ed is an introvert or extrovert and what he does in his free time.
They made it, and they're telling you how. You're listening to the CEO Series with Carl Moore on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CEO Series. We're speaking today in Calgary with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. Are you more of an introvert or extrovert?
I'm more of an introvert.
But as a CEO, there's times you've got to act a bit more of the personality. Meetings don't start till you enter the room sometimes. And you have thousands of people waiting for you to say something inspiring.
I'm an introvert in the world's most extroverted airline because this airline relies on hugs. It relies on
humor.
Very often it relies on that sense of trust from meeting a person and feeling confident in a person. It's not that I can't stand up in front of a room of a few hundred people, or it's not that I don't hug my flight attendants when I operate with them and fly with them. It's just I find it more draining than a natural extrovert would find that. So I find that I have to have private time after I've been, you know, on show or on display or on stage, simply just to kind of recover and regather my thoughts.
So how do you recharge? Is it by reading or walking a dog, or how do you recharge?
Those two, physical exercise is incredibly important for me. So I've exercised and trained. I got to a point in COVID after the first couple of months where I realized I was doing almost no physical exercise because I just wasn't leaving this office. So I made a commitment to myself in the middle of May 2020 that I would exercise for an hour every day. I would do something. And I have done that ever since.
Wow.
Found an hour simply to make sure that I lose myself in some sort of physical activity, even if it's just walking.
So have you taken up ice hockey?
I have not, because I can't skate.
So what kind of exercise do you do?
I run, okay. I train, I do circuits, I do boot camps, and I walk. So it's not mountain climbing. It's nothing, you know, desperately exciting, but at least it's outdoors and at least it's physically exerting. But I do still read as a hangover from my days as a literature student, and I can lose myself in novels.
So what book are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book about the Sackler family called The Empire of Pain, about the family who developed Valium, Librium, and then went on to develop OxyContin. And for me, again, it's a real wake-up call in some of the bad habits that very wealthy people have created in the world.
So fiction and non-fiction both?
Yeah, I probably would naturally read more fiction than non-fiction for the reason of escapism.
Hello again, I'm Carl Moore from McGill University, and you're listening to the CO Series. We're speaking today in Calgary with Ed Sims, CEO of WestJet. So you're moving back to New Zealand. If I might be so bold, what brings this on?
What brings?
Leaving WestJet and moving back to Australia.
Quite simply, family. When pre-COVID, my two older children, my daughter of 24 and my son of 21, would come up to Canada twice a year, and I'd go down to New Zealand twice a year, and we could manage our way through that process. When COVID hit, in reality, I haven't seen my two older children now for 2 years.
Wow.
I see them regularly on Messenger, but I haven't held them. I haven't hugged them for those 2 years. And I still firmly believe there is no more important role that I have in this world than as a parent. And I've missed a couple of critical years of their personal development. And as they are making their moves, just as I made many years ago, into the world of work, I want to be there to support them. And I've been very fortunate to have some extraordinary life experiences, and I want to share those with them at a more personal level than a formal lecture over Facebook Messenger.
So are you going to retire, or what are you going to do?
I'm very fortunate that I've got a few options. One is that, we were bought by Canada's largest independent private equity company, Onyx, 2 years ago in the largest private equity deal in aviation history. Onyx have asked if I would continue to stay on and advise them. And they're very interested in the Asia-Pacific aviation market because it remains the fastest-growing market in the world. And that's something I'm very excited about. I'm also very excited about building on the investment that I've made in the last 5 years in Canada. And I've been offered a couple of very interesting board positions here in Canada that could see me come back 3 to 4 times a year. I'm trying to arrange it that it's not in February. We'll see how that shapes up. But the idea of balancing perhaps some advising and consulting roles for Onyx with board positions here in Canada, for me, is the best of all worlds. But I don't intend to go back into a full-time management.
You lived in Canada for a number of years now. How are you going to be a bit Canadian when you go back to New Zealand? Like, is there going to be a Canadian, like, obviously not ice hockey, since you don't skate, but are your Kiwi friends going to go, "You've changed a bit, Ed. You're a little bit, you're Canadian."
Yeah, I think that's right. I think when I left New Zealand, I was probably more hard-nosed and more transactional in terms of my focus on corporate life. And I think I have described my time in Canada as life-affirming. I found that there is room for authentic, humane, and empathetic leadership. And I can't decide whether that's the subliminal and influence of how polite Canadians are, or whether that is post-COVID that those elements of compassion and empathy have become more pronounced. It really doesn't matter. I think as a person, I have almost rediscovered the critical role of humanity in leadership.
I would hope it's Canada, maybe WestJet a bit, but I think it's COVID-19, where mental health now, perhaps because of the woman at the Olympic and then the woman at the French tennis, where a lot of older people made fun of them and said, like, suck it up. Other people disagreed, and I think we've evolved, where mental health now is more of a real conversation.
I think that's absolutely right. I have looked to drive the same level of measurement and metrics in mental health that we have in physical health. It's relatively easy on physical health. You can always record lost time injuries and total disabling injuries. It's much harder in the area of mental well-being because the root cause is so much harder to define. But, I think I was also shaped by my years in air traffic control, where there is, considerable pressure on the individual if they allow themselves to think about the magnitude and the importance of their job. And I've seen circumstances that have led up to people making drastic decisions, taking their own lives or self-harm. And I think one of the lessons from COVID and one of the lessons from my time in Canada, Carl, has been identify those root causes really early on, just like you do in the world of operational safety or physical health and safety, and make sure that somebody somewhere is joining up the dots for another individual. And you can't have five individuals, all of whom have 20% of a jigsaw that could have helped the 100% that stopped somebody taking that drastic decision. Let's make sure you always have somebody who is fully across somebody's personal circumstances and has the authority and the commitment to intervene at an earlier stage. And I think that unquestionably makes us stronger leaders.
This is the CEO Series. Ed, thanks for joining us today, eh? We also thank our technical producer, Marco Companion, our show producer, Youssef Sahoni. Thank you for tuning into the CEO Series. À la prochaine.